Some Egyptian vessels built to carry obelisks along the Nile stretched to roughly 100 meters in length. That is longer than any warship constructed during the entire era of wooden sailing ships. Think of that for a moment, Alina. Before gunpowder, before the compass, before any empire we typically call great, humans were already engineering floating infrastructure at a scale that staggers the modern mind. Clay tablets and containers, surviving from at least 4000 BCE, record these early boats. The evidence is not myth, it is administrative record, the ancient world's version of a shipping manifest. Now, the key idea here is not that ships were impressive machines, it is that ships were the original network hardware. Every civilization that scaled beyond its local valley did so because it found a way to move weight across water cheaply and reliably. Ancient Egypt depended on the Nile precisely because the river offered an uninterrupted navigable corridor. Goods, stone, soldiers, and ideas all moved along it. By the 3rd millennium BCE, Egyptian vessels were already reaching Crete and later Phoenicia, connecting distinct political and commercial regions of the eastern Mediterranean. A canal linking the Nile to the Red Sea then extended that reach down the eastern coast of Africa. The ocean was not a barrier, it was a highway, and whoever controlled the highway controlled what moved along it. That control created a feedback loop, and understanding it is the core mechanism of this entire course. Here is how it worked. Maritime trade generated surplus wealth. Surplus wealth funded better ships and larger crews. Better ships extended a state's reach into new markets and new sources of raw material. That extended reach generated more wealth, which funded more ships. Phoenician and Cretan shipbuilders formalized this logic by specializing their vessels. Warships were long and narrow, built for speed and the transport of fighting men. Merchant ships were wide and deep, built to maximize cargo with small crews. The contrasting hull forms were not aesthetic choices. They reflected two opposing economic priorities: combat performance versus cargo efficiency. The Romans understood this distinction clearly. They maintained organized fleets both to counter rival maritime powers and to suppress piracy that threatened Mediterranean trade routes. Naval power, remember, performs two connected functions: sea control, which enables friendly commerce, and sea denial, which makes an enemy's navigation dangerous. Control the sea lanes, and you control the tax base. Control the tax base, and you build the fleet that controls the sea lanes. The loop is self-reinforcing. Ships also carried something harder to measure than cargo tonnage. Maritime routes moved people, cultural practices, technologies, and religious influences between coastal societies. Sri Lanka became a strategic stopover on several oceanic trade routes, a meeting place for merchants, sailors, pilgrims, and travelers from radically different backgrounds. Quanzhou, a major Chinese seaport, maintained extensive connections with the Muslim world from the 9th to the 15th century. In the Philippines, archaeological evidence at Butuan revised earlier assumptions entirely, demonstrating regional maritime trade from at least the early 10th century, earlier than scholars had previously assumed. The Skirky Bank, a maritime contact zone between the western and eastern Mediterranean, connected Carthage and Rome in antiquity, supported medieval trade between Sicily and North Africa, and later became a site of conflict in two world wars. The same stretch of water functioned successively as a commercial corridor, a cultural meeting place, and a battlefield. Ports and sea lanes, Alina, were imperial infrastructure. Controlling them offered access to trade, military movement, taxation, and cultural exchange simultaneously. The takeaway is this: the ship is not a vehicle. It is the foundational hardware upon which the modern global economy was programmed. Every empire that achieved genuine global reach, from Rome to the maritime republics of the medieval Mediterranean, did so by mastering the feedback loop between naval technology, trade wealth, and political power. The hull of a ship is where that loop begins. It determines how much cargo moves, how fast, at what cost, and under whose protection. Change the hull, and you change the economics. Change the economics, and you change who holds power. That is why the history of ships is not a niche subject for maritime enthusiasts. It is the operating system of human civilization. In the next lecture, Alina, we examine the mechanical revolution that broke the coastal horizon entirely, the age of discovery, the science of navigation, and the moment blue water sailing transformed regional networks into a single interconnected world.